Welcome to the Marketplace Roundtable podcast. We speak with Seeking Alpha Marketplace authors about their investing styles, their views on the market, and their favorite investing ideas. I'm your host, Nathaniel Baker. Before we begin, a brief disclaimer. Seeking Alpha is a website where authors from around the world share their ideas and analysis on the stock market. The Marketplace is our platform for authors to run investing analysis and idea services so that readers can take their investing to the next level. Nothing on this podcast should be taken as investment advice. A full set of disclosures will be provided at the end of this podcast. For reference purposes, this podcast was recorded on Tuesday, September 17th, 2019. I am joined today by longtime contributor to SeekingAlpha.com, Michael Kramer of Mott Capital Management. Michael has been active on Seeking Alpha since 2014 and a professional investor going back to 1994, so a full quarter century. He is the founder of Reading the Markets, a premium research service here on Seeking Alpha. A subscription to the Reading the Markets research service gets you exclusive ideas, a subscriber-only live chat room, direct access to the author, video and audio updates. You can find out more on Seeking Alpha by searching for Mott Capital. That's M like Mike, O-T-T. A free 2-week trial is available. And you can also follow Michael and Mott Capital on Twitter, which I do. And I can tell you he's pretty active there. The handle is Michael Mott CM. CM is in capital management. All right. That out of the way, let's get into it. Michael, welcome to the podcast.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Great to have you. Let's start off. Why don't you just tell me a little bit about your investing strategy?
So I have a pretty interesting investing strategy because I've had worn a lot of different hats over the years. And I have what I consider to be a long-term focus, which is thematic growth. And then I have what I consider to be a shorter term to medium term focus, which is using the market as a guide to help me figure out, you know, stocks that may rise or fall or sectors that may go up or down, which is what I really predominantly focus on with the Reading the Markets marketplace service.
Right. Interesting. And is there what, so you've been doing this obviously for quite a while.
Yeah.
Years. Full quarter century, several cycles that you've seen already in your career. Is there a key lesson that you've learned in your investing over time?
Mostly it's about being patient. You know, when I was young, I started investing, I should say, in 1994, 95. I was about 16, 17 years old at the time. So I wasn't technically professional, but my career span has been very long because I just took an interest in it at such a young age. You know, I invested throughout my college career and I started making money for myself investing when I was about 18, 19 years old. So I started using that money to pay for my tuition and such. You know, that was in the late 90s, you know, 96, 97. And it was obviously a very, you know, it was a nice period of time where the markets were going up. But, you know, people tend to think that, you know, the late 90s was all, you know, easy. It really wasn't. And when you think back to it, you know, you had the financial currency crisis in the late 90s in Asia. You had long-term capital management. So you had all sorts of little hiccups along the way. And I think, you know, I use that a lot as a guide because you've lived through these different cycles. And, you know, history tends to repeat itself in a lot of different ways. So, you know, it's, you know, like I'll reference a lot of it when I'm doing like a commentary. I do a lot of video commentaries on the service. And, you know, I'll say, you know, this reminds me of a certain time. And it's like I can pull that as a reference. And it's almost like because you've lived through a similar experience, it gives you an advantage over, you know, maybe newer newcomers or, you know, people with less experience or less time under their belt.
Interesting. Yeah, I remember those days as well. You know, the Asian currency crisis, which was 97, fall 97.
Yeah.
And then long-term capital management, which was 98.
Right.
And those were pretty big shocks to the system.
Right.
It wasn't until 99. In 99, then the bulls were on full.
That was the kind of the euphoric moment, right? Mm-hmm. Everyone talks about, You know, you don't hit a turning point in the bull market until you really get that euphoria.
Right.
And people talk today about, you know, how we're in this bull run that's whatever the terms may be, long in the tooth, one of the terms that I really can't stand to hear, because where's the euphoria today, you know? And it's nothing like, if you lived through the late 90s, 99, so to speak, it's nothing like, today is nothing like that time period, where at that time you could be throwing darts at a board and you could pick out winners, and that was a much easier period of time. Not anything like it is today, I should just say.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. And anybody who remembers 1999 and the euphoria that was going on there with the tech stocks and everything like that, you know, as we record this, you know, that we just hear that the WeWork IPO has been delayed. There were no delays to any IPOs.
Right. Everything was getting priced.
And not only priced, but, you know, in many ways, like the day of the IPO shooting up, you know, at several multiples.
Right. All you had to have was a .com at the end of your name.
Yeah. Crazy times. But so more recent history, you know, this last year has been really difficult, you know, going back to the, you know, the sell-off that we had in the fourth quarter of last year. What's something new that you'd say that you've learned in the markets over this past year?
The speed of the market is frightening at times. And I think that people don't appreciate that. The market does today, in a matter of weeks, what it used to take months and sometimes several months to do, right? I mean, a 24% or a 20% drawdown in the S&P and a 24 or 25% drawdown in the Russell within a month. I mean, that was like unheard of even during, you know, 2008, 2009. And I was living through that period. I was a buy-side equity trader at a very, you know, large multi-billion dollar firm, trading, you know, international domestic equities, and the moves, you know, I remember being on the desk that Lehman went, you know, bust, and, you know, talking to the guys over there, and the moves today happen at light speed compared to even then, and a lot of that is because of the creation of ETFs, passive investing, and all these high frequency trading, and people don't understand and grasp the concept that, you know, as an ETF goes down, it's pushing down all the stocks in the basket. And as those stocks in the basket go down, those ETFs have to go down, and it just creates more selling pressure. So that's so the one thing I've really learned today is you have to be patient. You have to know what you're investing in. You have to know your stories. You have to know them better than the market so that you can sit there and know that, hey, what's happening right now in XYZ is nothing to function with the company, but a function of what's happening in the marketplace. And I think that's very hard to do. A lot of people don't have the stomach for that, but that's really what the advantage is today, is patience.
And you mentioned the macro picture, and it says here on your Seeking Alpha page that 2/3 of investing starts at the macro level and works its way down. So what do you have a certain view of the macro picture right now?
Yeah, I mean, I'm very bullish on the equity market. I actually believe the equity market is entering its next phase of the bull run, which is very, there aren't many people out there who are saying this right now, but I do believe that the equity market is on the cusp of a move that we saw, you know, in late 2016 through the beginning of 2018, maybe a period similar to that to the end of 2013 through the period of 2015. I think we're on the start of the next leg up over the next 1 to 2 years, which I know not many people are thinking about. But when you look at the valuations in the equity market, when you look at interest rates in the financial and fixed income, when you look at the fact that PE multiples for forwards are trading at really levels that are historically low versus the average and the norms, you know, I really can get a point. I can get a valuation on the S&P of about 3,400 just next year. And that's really what I've been thinking about. And that's something I'm really focused on, right? Because once I can get the direction of the market, I can begin to think about the sectors that are going to outperform. And then the sectors I can drill down into actual stocks and then use, you know, fundamentals and options and technicals to really gauge the ones that I think are going to do better.
Interesting. So, yeah, 3,400 on the S&P, that's a, you know, another 10% or more, 15% about higher. What do you see as the catalyst for that?
I think if you look at the recent, and this is another example, if you look at the recent sector rotation that's taken place in the market and the stocks that are really performing well right now, they're all global growth proxies, industrials, materials, right? These are the sectors that have been really strong this quarter, energy, right? Outside of, before even what happened in Saudi Arabia over the weekend, the energy sector was the best performing sector this month. Financials, global reflation, right? You know, and then when you look at some of the sectors that were lagging, it was, you know, the staples, the utilities. August was very much a defensive month where you had utilities and staples leading. This month is different than what May and June were. And I have like this whole spreadsheet that I give to all my subscribers that you can access. And it shows every month how the sector rotation was. And sector rotation really tells me about what the mood of the market is. So when you look at this month, you have semiconductors. Think about, you know, everything today in our world that I could go in my kitchen and look around and everything has chips in it to some degree, right? From your dishwasher, your microwave, to your stove, to your computer, to your TV. Chips are used in everything. So in an environment where semiconductors are doing well, it's a global growth proxy. Where you have materials rising, it's because you need commodities to build stuff. You need gypsum board to build homes. You need all the copper for piping. Well, not so much anymore because people use PEX, right? But, and I know that because I'm doing a project in my house where I'm replacing all the copper pipe.
I was going to say that. I don't know. That was common knowledge, but go on, yeah.
And when you look at industrials, right, very economically sensitive, these are sectors that are going to do well in a reflation trade, in a trade where you have improving global growth. If you look at some of the Asian markets, South Korea KOSPI recently broke out of its August highs, actually broke out before the S&P 500. What do they do? They're mainly an export economy. Japan, Nikkei just broke out. Export economy. German DAX very close to a breakout. Export economy. You have signs of stabilizing purchasing managers, manufacturing indexes over there. And so when you look at all these things, we've gone through a cycle now where I believe we've troughed in the cycle. And that's going to, and you're going to be returning to global growth. You layer that on the potential of a trade deal, which I do believe is going to happen sooner than later, because there are already signs that both sides are starting to play a little nicer. Add to the backdrop of easing monetary policy around the world, from the Fed to the ECB to the BOJ. Well, they've always been in easy mode, but it's going to help create and stimulate some of this growth, right? Copper prices have recently broke out. Iron ore prices are on the rise. Soybean prices are even rising. So that's why I believe we're entering the next phase higher in the equity market. Plus, another layer, there's only been three times since 1994 that the S&P 500 dividend yield has traded below that of the 10-year treasury. 2009, 2012 and 13, 2015 and 16. 2013 was a year of about an 18-month period of sideways consolidation in the S&P 500. That was during the European debt crisis and everything, Greeks, Brexit. And then 2015, 2016, you have the global growth scare. We've been in a period of sideways consolidation again, basically since peaking January 26, 2018, just until now. We're only about 3 or 4% higher than where we were almost 18 or 19 months ago, more than that. Very similar periods of time, 13, 15, and now. And so that's why, and all those periods also had in common dividend yield on the S&P 500 higher than 10-year treasury rate. And so that's really how I'm thinking about this whole cycle.
That's really interesting. I want to ask you what exactly this means for various sectors and then drill down into that and what it might mean for certain stocks. When we come back, let's just take first a quick break. I am speaking with Michael, who runs Reading the Markets Marketplace service here at Seeking Alpha. You can sign up for the service either by going to seekingalpha.com/marketplace and looking for Reading the Markets, or by typing Reading the Markets or Mott Capital Management, that's M like Mike, O-T-T, into the site search bar at seekingalpha.com. Okay, welcome back. Michael, talking about these global, tailwinds for growth, at least, Where does that leave you in terms of your views on the various sectors? And I may have already answered my question that you may like growth stocks, et cetera. But yeah, what are your thoughts then on the various sectors of the equity markets?
So you're gonna see a period of risk on sentiment come into the marketplace. It's already here. It's been here, right? But I think in terms of you're gonna see material stocks start performing well, industrials performing well. Industrials, actually, the XLI just broke out of a massive period of consolidation. I think you're going to see a return to growth in the Russell stocks, the small caps. Technology is still going to do well. I don't know that it's going to do as well as it has, just because I think there'll be pockets of technology that will do well. Consumer discretionaries will obviously do very well. Sectors that I think won't do well, utilities, industrials, healthcare. Now, you got to be careful, right? Because there's healthcare, which is the XLV, I usually proxy it to. And then there's the XBI, which is biotech. I don't consider them to be the same. I know some people will lump them together. XBI biotech is very much a risk on play, right? You have low interest rates. These companies are going to get cheap money. They can grow their businesses. XLV healthcare, which is more of the insurers, I think of, the big pharmaceuticals, I think those sectors will be more defensive. Those are more defensive in nature. Those are stocks and parts of the market that likely underperform. And then financials could actually do very well in this type of environment, especially if interest rates do begin to start rising again, which will help widen the yield curves and help the banks with net interest incomes. And hopefully, you know, a return to growth helps push loan growth higher for them. They could be another sector that does fairly well in this environment.
We're probably a ways away from seeing higher rates in the Fed, though, right?
Yes and no. I think rates on the short end of the curve have further to fall. I think on the longer end, 10-year, 30-year, I think we're pretty much going to be stabilizing in this 1.75 to 2.25 region on the 10-year yield. I think 10-year yields probably got too low in August. I do think, so I look at the yields, and I determine which way yields are going to go, or basically I look at the spreads between, you know, 10-year yields in the U.S. versus Germany versus Japan. So 10-year yields, I was one of the very few people in November or December of 2018, when yields were around 3%, I said yields were going to go to under 2.3% this year. I didn't think they were going to get to 1.5, right? But I based that off the spread. German yields to U.S. yields had reached record levels, not since the 1989 was the last time they were that wide. And the spread had gotten so wide that it became apparent to me that there was going to be a reversion to the mean, meaning that U.S. yields had to fall dramatically to those of yields in Europe. And now that spread is almost contracted back to like a historical norm of like 2015, 2016 in that 2 to 2.25 region. And so for that reason, I think yields on the long end are now back in agreement with what's happening around the rest of the world. So I think those yields will stay pretty much flat to neutral, but I think the shorter end does have a lot of room to fall, especially as the Fed starts cutting rates. And that will help to steepen the yield curve and help the banks out over the next year or two.
Yeah, that's an interesting view. Yeah. What causes that spread? I mean, I would think that like the Germans and the U.S. yields kind of move together since they're both kind of safe haven trades, aren't they? I mean, there's no safer paper than U.S. Treasuries followed closely by German bonds, right?
Right. But I think the reason why you've seen that kind of divergence, right, is because last year, you have to remember, we had, you know, the U.S. economy was outperforming the rest of the world. You had a Federal Reserve, which was raising rates, while Europe and Japan and all those other nations were not raising rates, right? They were doing nothing, right? So that pushed all of our rates higher. And basically, that spread got so wide that our yields were too attractive now for other foreign investors to ignore, which is really what brought them back in.
Cool. Is there anything right now that scares you about the markets or your portfolio?
The scariest thing right now to me is the day-to-day headline risk, and it's just the speed of the market. I mean, 3% moves today have become like, I feel like almost commonplace. I tell this all the time to everyone in my videos and in my writings that 3% moves today are the equivalent of like what a 2% move was maybe 10 years ago. 2% moves used to be huge, you know, in the S&P. Now it's like a 2% move is like what a 1% move was. Moves today are so dramatic that they're scary. And because of the speed of the market and the way everything is so connected with ETFs and high frequency trading and everything, that's what the biggest risk to the market is today. It's how quickly we can fall 10%.
Flip side of that question, what's something that gives you confidence in your approach or investing?
For me, it's knowing that at the end of the day, markets always return to fundamentals. Things can only get out of alignment for so long before the fundamentals of the business take over again, right? Mm-hmm. And usually, like, we saw this in December, right? Everyone was, you know, you get these fears in the market about recession and all this other stuff. But if you take the time, which I did, and you go through the fundamentals of the market, you look at things like GDP growth projections, you look at forecasts as they come out, like with GDP now, you know, you read the actual ISM reports, you can see where the disconnect lies. You know, and if people took the time to actually read the ISM manufacturing reports in December, they would see that those numbers were nowhere near recessionary and that how dramatically more they had to actually fall. I mean, I think the ISMs in December were in the mid 50s, and a recession doesn't typically happen on the manufacturing index until it gets to like a 44. So. Right. You know, you have to say to yourself, can things really fall off a cliff that quickly? Mm. And when you start thinking about things more logically in that manner, that's when you can kind of take comfort and say, you know, I know things don't look very good right now, but, you know, based on everything I'm seeing, I can't come to the same conclusion that everyone's screaming about. And I manage money for myself. I have friends and family I run money for who are outside of the service and clients. And, you know, I have to write them a quarterly letter about what's happening and, you know, with their accounts and such. And I wrote in my fourth quarter letter that, you know, I expected the market to rise back to 3,000 this year.
And there's nothing now that concerns you? The manufacturing did dip into the most recent numbers. Right. I think we're literally 49.9, which is about just literally right below the and who knows, that's. Right. And then besides that, you also have inflation now ticking up, the latest CPIs.
Right.
Is any of that concern you at all or not?
So the manufacturing number doesn't concern me because I know that the number has to fall significantly more before we really have to start worrying about recession. If you read the report, the 49.9 corresponds to like a 1.9% GDP growth rate for the quarter, which is not, you know, you got two, I mean, it's not. I like it to be higher, but it's certainly not recessionary. That's number one. Number two, when I look at inflation rates, I don't worry because the key thing that I look at to gauge the direction of inflation, which many people don't, is the velocity of MZM. If you take the velocity of MZM and you overlay it with the 10-year treasury rate, the correlation is like nearly perfect, right? The two have tracked each other incredibly well. Since 1960s, right? So we got like 50 years of data to support this. And there's just not enough growth in GDP right now to really trigger inflation in a material way. We're printing more money than what GDP can grow at. And because of that, because velocity of MZM is just simply a mathematical equation, right? Nominal GDP divided by the MZM. And we print more MZM, so the only way you're going to get inflation back is if growth really accelerates on GDP, or the government stops printing, or the Fed stops printing MZM, or the creation of it, right, slows. And that's just not happening. So I don't really worry about inflation the way that everyone else does. It's, to me, the best indicator there is of future inflation. Mm-hmm. And right now, just for an example, in early 1980s, we created for every $1 in MZM created, there was about $3.80 in GDP created. Today, $1 in MZM created only creates $1.30 in GDP.
Yeah, good point. Okay, let's get out to the favorite ideas you have.
Right.
Yeah, so let's have them. What are some of your favorite ideas right now?
So on the longer term end of things, meaning that I bought them with an idea that I can hold them for the next 3 to 5 years, the stocks that I like the most are stocks like Disney, right? I love them for their move into streaming. I love Netflix. I've owned Netflix and Disney both for a number of years for myself and my clients.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah. I like them both for the streaming aspect. I believe that in the future, you're not just like when we were younger or when I was younger, I'm assuming you're a little bit older because you remember the 1990s.
Right.
You know, when you remember you being a kid, like you had to tune into like a certain channel at a certain time of the day to watch that favorite show. Yeah. Today, that's my kids. It's just like, what is a commercial, Dad? I don't even understand what that is. And, you know, so basically we're going to a world where we're going to be watching streaming services like we used to watch CBS or ABC, right? You know, all your favorite shows on Wednesday night were on CBS. Well, now all your favorite shows are on Netflix or they're on Disney, and that's it. And that's just the way I see things transpiring. So they're going to become, it's all going to be about who has the content and who's, you know, who's making it and where is it available. And those are the services you're going to keep, right? So that's why I like those two. I think they're both well positioned for that.
Well, just to ask you on that, play a little bit of devil's advocate. That's it. You don't hear too many people being long both Disney and Netflix right now because, you know, Disney obviously with their streaming service that they're launching in a couple of months, I think, is going to be now a direct competitor. And there are others.
Right.
So Netflix now all of a sudden has many more competitors where a couple of years ago they just kind of didn't. And it does become, to your point, very much a play about original content, original programming. And is none of that a concern as a Netflix shareholder?
No, and I'll tell you why. Because if you want to watch, if one of your favorite shows is Stranger Things, you're not going to find it on Disney, right? Mm-hmm. And if you want to watch Disney is, look, I'm going to be a subscriber to both. I have two young kids. I have a daughter who's 8 and a daughter who's 5. They love everything on, you know, Disney, but they also love Netflix. Right. And they love shows that are on Netflix that they're not going to get on Disney. Disney's going to have a very, you know, people think at the end of the day, you're going to watch Disney. You have to like the shows that Disney puts on it. You're going to have to be a fan of Star Wars. You're going to have to be a fan of Marvel. You're going to have to want to watch kids shows. Right. If you're going to want to watch Stranger Things or Cable Girls or any of these other shows on Netflix, I can't think of at the top of my head. You're going to have to own Netflix. Right. And plus, you want to talk about pricing, right? Netflix is $15 a month. I mean, right now for myself, my wife, my two daughters to go to the movies where I live, it costs me like $100 because there's no way I'm walking into that movie theater with an 8 and a 5-year-old and not buying popcorn and soda. Right. So for basically 1 year, I can get Netflix. Or, you know, a year and a half, basically for $150, I can get Netflix for a year, or I can go to the movies for one time, maybe 1.5 times, right? So from that standpoint, it's worth it, right? And Disney is going to price their service at $6 and Netflix is so I'm spending $21 a month for two streaming services, right? What is my cable bill running me right now, right? A lot more. So that money, what I believe is going to happen is cable providers are going to be the big losers here, which is the reason why you've seen Comcast make its acquisition of Universal. I mean, not Universal, of NBC, right? Because they need to get into content. They need to own content to put on their own platform, right? So because they know, and I believe a lot of these cable guys know, and they realize that when you roll out 5G, which everyone's going to have 5G on their phones very soon, and they're going to have it in their homes probably, you're not going to need a landline into your house anymore. You're not going to need the fiber into your house anymore. Because those 5G speeds are going to be just as fast as, if not faster than, the cable line. So you're not going to have All the right. cable bill anymore.
What about, okay, so that's two ideas, NFLX and Disney. What about some others?
So on a shorter term trading ideas, you know, I've recently written about you know, AT&T. There's been a lot of bullish betting in AT&T recently. I just published an article on the free site about it. The technicals look very strong on AT&T. You obviously have everything that's happening with Elliott management right now. So on the shorter term, I've been looking, I'm looking for like AT&T to probably rise about 10 to 12% here. That's one of my, one of the things I've recently written about. Another stock that I've recently written about that I was kind of more bearish on was Square.
Right.
Square, the valuation to me is very expensive when you compare it to a lot of the other payment processor types. It's about double. You know, they always seem to disappoint every quarter. They come out, they beat guidance, but then their guidance for the next quarter is always worse than what the market's looking for. They've done this like every quarter now for the last couple quarters. I went back and I looked. Basically, like their guidance, so they'll come out, they beat the second quarter, then they come out and they give you really bad third quarter guidance, the stock goes down. And I don't really see that trend changing at the moment. I think expectations get too high and then they come out and then they have to guide down. So Square, I've been seeing a lot of put buying in that one more recently. The technical chart looks broken to me. And I've been thinking that that one could fall to around 51 or so.
Mm-hmm.
What else? You want another one or is that good?
Yeah, let's have another one, sure.
And then let me see, another one that I recently wrote about was AMD. AMD, I've been seeing a little bit of put buying in that one as well more recently. The technical, the stock just acts really poorly. The semiconductor has been, semiconductor sector has been a really strong sector this month. And AMD has really kind of lagged. And, you know, partly it's because AMD is up a lot this year. But when stocks start underperforming their sector, and it can't break out of a range, I tend to begin to think that that's because the stock is going to start going lower. There just aren't enough buyers in the marketplace now really to push this thing higher. And so that's why I've been kind of feeling a little bit negative on AMD as well. And I think I had it down to around, I think I saw it maybe falling to around 27 bucks or so.
Interesting. Okay, those are good picks. Thanks so much for that. We are out of time. If you've been enjoying the Seeking Alpha Marketplace Roundtable podcast, you can subscribe through iTunes, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, Spotify, and virtually everywhere else you find podcasts. All you do is search for Marketplace Roundtable. You can also give reviews on those platforms to help other investors discover this podcast. I have been speaking with Michael Kramer, who runs the Reading the Markets Marketplace service here at Seeking Alpha. You can sign up for his service either by going to seekingalpha.com/marketplace and looking for Reading the Markets, or by typing Reading the Markets or Michael Kramer into the site search bar at seekingalpha.com. You can also follow Mike on seekingalpha.com and enjoy his free content there. Final disclosures, Nathaniel Baker, I do have some positions in some of the securities mentioned today, namely Disney and AT&T, a couple of small long positions that I've held for a while, but I do have to disclose that. And Michael, what about you?
So I own Disney and I own Netflix. I've held them both for about 3 years plus and have no intentions of selling them anytime soon. But that's it.
Okay, wonderful. That is great. Thank you so much for listening, and we look forward to speaking to you again next time.